From Sealands Grove to Beaver Falls, Gettysburg to Erie, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, after months of hearings, the House State Government Committee has issued a report proposing reforms to Pennsylvania's election process. State Representative Seth Grove is chairman of that committee. He is here to talk about the report. Concordia Place meets social needs through programs that provide growth and opportunity for children, teens, and adults. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Brenda Schwartz of Concordia Place in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And our nation's energy resources are a vital component of a vibrant economy. But on her Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity PA says state and national policies are threatening to drive up energy costs. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to State Representative Seth Grove in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. It is budget season in Pennsylvania, with a deadline of June 30th for lawmakers to pass a new spending plan. But as usual, the battle lines have been drawn between Governor Tom Wolf and the Republican-controlled General Assembly. At issue this year is how to spend the $7.3 billion in federal economic stimulus funds that the state will receive under the American Rescue Plan. According to the Center Square, House Speaker Brian Cutler wants to spend the money paying for current bills and programs rather than starting new programs. Democrats, however, have proposed something they have termed Pennsylvania's New Deal, which is a collection of new big spending programs. Additionally, the state is likely to end the current fiscal year with close to a $2 billion surplus, which Republicans say undercuts the governor's claim of the state having a structural budget deficit. Despite being flush with cash, Wolf continues to call for a major increase in personal income taxes, something not likely to win legislative approval. In the wake of voter approval last month of two state constitutional amendments giving the legislature the power to curb the governor's emergency declaration powers, lawmakers are preparing to do just that. A resolution has already been drafted and voted out of committee, positioning it for a floor vote when election results are certified. Among other things, the resolution would end the governor's power to hand out contracts without soliciting bids. House Majority Leader Kerry Benninghoff told the Center Square that legislators will, quote, terminate the most devastating portions, end quote, of the governor's emergency declarations, which have forced draconian shutdown measures on many businesses, supposedly to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania was at the epicenter of last November's disputed presidential election, with many of the state's election laws subjected to harsh criticism. The House State Government Committee has conducted 10 hearings on the election process and recently issued its report. State Representative Seth Grove of York County is chairman of that committee. He joins us now to discuss the report and its findings. Seth, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Seth, before we get into the highlights and recommendations of the report, give us a little bit of background, what your committee was charged with doing, how you went about the process that you used in producing this report.
Yeah, thanks, Loman. Appreciate the time, and always great to join you talking about numerous stuff impacting Pennsylvania. Obviously, coming into the chairmanship of the House State Government Committee, one of the preeminent things we wanted to address early on was election issues here in the Commonwealth. We have a law that's dated back to 1937. Of course, it's been updated, but I mean, you can still find King's language in our election system, which provides the opportunity for individuals to create loopholes and create opportunities to take election law stuff to court to get the court to make decisions. We wanted to take a step back and say, what's exactly in our election law and how is that administered in the Commonwealth? And I think it worked out well. We held 10 hearings. Each hearing was on a specific topic within the election system, from voter registration all the way to post-election audit process at the end of the election system. So cycle. So we wanted to make sure we had a comprehensive approach and get our due diligence piece by piece to build in reforms each step of the way to make sure we have the best election system in the country, one that is grounded in integrity and one that provides full accessibility to legal voters here in the Commonwealth.
Let's take a look now at some of the highlights and recommendations that were included in the report. And let's start out talking, Seth, about the Pennsylvania Department of State, which for those who don't know, the Pennsylvania Department of State is the agency, the cabinet level agency in state government that does oversee elections. In 2020, Seth, there was a lot of controversy around the Department of State. So what sort of recommendations for reform came out of your hearings relative to that department?
There's a lot of overlap between recommendations. And the biggest probably issue we dealt with the Department of State this year, obviously we made major changes in 2019-2020 session year as with regards to election changes. But the department came out with these guidance documents to help counties administer their elections. So it's basically the department coming back and saying, here's recommendations we're making to improve it. And some are directives that say, the statute requires this, so you have to go do this. Or if a court case pops up, right, we learned this from the court case, here's how we want to see you handle this. And the goal is to provide uniformity and standardization amongst all the counties. From what we saw with this Department of State and how they handled stuff, it was very political. And even with that first hearing, we saw former Secretary of State Kathleen Buchvar, repeatedly say, I felt it should go like this. I felt the election law. So they basically drove a lot of the guidance towards what they wanted to see. Good example is these drop boxes for mail-in ballots. And nowhere in the statute does it provide for that mechanism for people to go vote. But they administratively created it, which brings inconsistency. Some counties had tons of drop boxes. Other counties didn't use any at all. So, again, not providing that uniformity. The secretary took an issue to court about signature verification. She felt our language wasn't, the statute wasn't clear. So she actually filed suit in court. The court took it up, Supreme Court took it up, and that's how signature verification was removed out of the election process. So a lot of manipulation by the Department of State through those guidance documents. So one of the recommendations is create more consistency. A lot of states have operational manuals that they lock in at the beginning of the year. Every county treats it like law, and they have to abide by those operational manuals throughout the entire year, which provides actual standardization. And then they're developed by actual elections directors to build in best practices. And that's a really good direction we need to go in to reform the Commonwealth.
We are talking with State Representative Seth Grove. He is chairman of the House State Government Committee. We're talking about the report, A Comprehensive Review of Pennsylvania Election Law. Seth, one of the big areas of controversy, an area that has raised concerns about the security of the election, were no excuse in mail-in balloting. Can you talk a bit about what you learned in the hearing process and what recommendations you might have relative to going forward when it comes to these mail-in ballots?
Number one, they lack security and integrity features. Again, the Supreme Court removed the signature match requirement out of those. So there's no way to verify those signatures to make sure that you, Lohman Henry, are the person actually signing that. And that creates an uniform precedent among voters, because when you vote in person, there's a signature match requirement. When you go in to vote, you have to, you know, sign the book. So you need to make sure you have uniformity, whether it's process issues, making sure that drop boxes are secure, making sure you have chain of custody, making sure that you have a specific count of how many ballots were sent out, how many were returned, making sure you have transparent process, making sure observers are present. So there's a lot of reforms in that system we have to do to make sure it's, number one, best practices, and number two, has the utmost security and integrity provisions brought into it so we can guarantee that it is accurate and we don't have any, unfortunately, bad actors that may want to step in and manipulate that system moving forward. So there are a lot of recommendations to improve that process moving forward.
one of the hot button issues here also is having a voter ID, a photo ID. Mm-hmm. Did the committee touch on that? And it seems to me that having a voter ID is common sense, but it has become highly politicized. Any recommendations from the committee as to what we should do there?
Yeah, absolutely recommended that we have voter ID. And we do have a voter ID policy here in the Commonwealth. The recommendation to expand that for every person walking in to vote. They should have to show some form of ID. Under current Pennsylvania law, you have 16 options of IDs that you can show. Everything from your driver's license to a utility bill to a letter from the government. So if you have a letter from Department of Welfare that verifies your address, you can show that. And what that does is close a very important loophole. So we have a lot of individuals who are listed as inactive on our voter registration list. So these are individuals that are registered to vote, but oftentimes don't vote. And our election system in person is predicated on the 1937 notion that the election poll workers knows everybody in their town. Well, that's not true today because we have a very transient society. So having a voter ID for in-person voting closes that loophole and ensures that those election officials working in your polling place actually know who you are when you go to vote, to make sure someone doesn't try to manipulate the inactive voter list and tries to pass themselves off as someone they're not.
There, of course, were a lot of concerns, allegations that were raised after the 2020 election, Seth, when it came to allegations of fraud and inconsistencies, et cetera. And without getting in the tall weeds of all that, one of the ways to ensure that there is confidence in the outcome of the election are post-election audits. Did the committee make any recommendation for Pennsylvania to have a robust system of post-election audits so that we can restore that integrity?
Yeah, one of the things we learned is every single state has a similar post-election audit process. That process is either the Department of State or the counties do their audit process, which the committee had a lot of problems with because they administer the election, so they're kind of required to do their own checks on themselves. A true audit is going to be independent, right? You're going to have an independent entity look at that audit process and make sure that is a true view of what's happening within that process. So one of the recommendations is to have the Auditor General take over the post-election audit process. And this kind of comes from Speaker Brian Cutler's legislation. Create a Bureau of Elections within the Auditor General's office. They will do all the election audit post-election audit processes on top of making sure that everything that is auditable in the election process has an audit done to it. So making sure the tabulation machines are audited, making sure that the logs on the machines are audited. The proposal is actually the strongest post-election audit process in the entire country. It's the only one that's proposed to be truly independent and will verify not only the outcome of the election, but the processes used in that election. So we're really excited for that provision.
Seth Grove represents the 196th Legislative District in York County. He is chairman of the House State Government Committee. The report is a comprehensive review of Pennsylvania election law. And Seth, if we have listeners who would like to read the report, learn more about your recommendations, where can they go on the web to get that information?
Easy enough. Just go to my website, repgrove.com. Click on State Government Committee. There is a full listing of all the 10 hearings, plus the videos of them, as well as the report highlighted front and center. So really easy to go find.
Seth Grove, thank you for being with us.
Lohman, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Unmet social needs hamper the lives of many, but Concordia Place provides services that offer growth and opportunity to children, teens, and adults. Brenda Schwartz is president and CEO of Concordia Place. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has her in the Community Benefit Spotlight.
Thank you, Lohman, and thank you, Brenda, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program.
Great to be here.
Brenda, you're the president and CEO of an organization called Concordia Place out of Chicago, Illinois, and you're a very inclusive program in that you don't discriminate against anybody, age, race, economic level. I want you to talk about what the inspiration was to get Concordia Place started back in the 1980s.
You know, we call it the story of the three Barbaras. It's one where you really, as all stories start, it's kind of once upon a time, but it's really a true story where there were three single mothers And it really just so happens all of them were named Barbara. And they needed help with after-school care for their children. And really, they didn't have much for means. And they were trying to figure out what to do with after-school care. They had kind of pieced together a lot of different things. And so they went to the neighborhood church and asked the pastor, could you help with child care? And the pastor at the time was right out of seminary. And I think all of us, when we're young and right out of school, it's kind of, how hard can that be? You know a lot.
Sure. Well, a lot of organizations would have really worked to expand the child care program, but you expanded into much more over the many years.
We have. At the time, the church was really facing a lot of its own problems. And the story of the three Barbaras is really the story of being a place of yes and how oftentimes there's a lot of reasons to say no. There's, we don't know how to do it. We've never done it before. We don't have the money. And in this case, the three Barbaras, they were not even members of the church. So this was a story of the church expanding beyond its own members and beyond the walls and finding a way to say yes to the community. And that's what we've continued to do in the almost 40 years that we have been serving the community. So we've gone from that single after-school program to now we serve approximately 800 people in Chicago each year from ethnically, linguistically, economically diverse communities.
So Brenda, a lot of people do have the philosophy of no. There are so many ways to say no and walk away from it. It's a very courageous philosophy and approach to be a culture of yes. That's terrific.
It's one that certainly opens a lot of doors, and sometimes then when you get to that place where then when you do have something, right, like when you have maybe nothing to risk, it's easier to say yes, right? Well, what do we have to lose? Our approach is that we are put here on this earth to serve, not to preserve our mission, and so this is where I think a lot of well-intentioned people and good, you know, mission-hearted people, They look at what they have and they're like, we have to do something really good and special with this. And then they look around and it's like they look at their balance sheet and they look around and they say, what should we do? And instead, what I think really makes Concordia Place special is that we look around and say, what needs to be done?
This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Brenda Swartz, who is the president CEO of an organization named Concordia Place. Brenda, with a philosophy and culture of yes, over the last year, there's been a lot of culture of no. How did you address that and work your way through it? What were your biggest challenges? What surprised you?
I think that in addressing the systemic causes, some of the systemic causes around poverty and social inequality, we're trying to, and it isn't something that works in every community, but in communities where you do have a diversity or you're near a community where you have the opportunity to draw from other communities. What we have found in Chicago is that when you can provide high quality education and learning, regardless of a family's economic level, there are families that do want to have their children in a classroom with other children that don't necessarily look like them, aren't from the same economic background as them, and have even different faith or family structures.
Sure, but with the social distancing and the wearing masks and and those kinds of things aren't normal challenges. And even for the community that you're serving, it had to create some kind of interesting conversations about how you were going to work through that.
Well, certainly the pandemic has put everyone on their head and changed the world, that's for sure. When we were mandated for the closure back in March of 2020 and the world shut down, the child care centers had to as well. But as soon as our governor realized that, look, nobody could go to work, including firefighters, grocery store workers, et cetera, it kind of pleaded with the child care centers and said, would you please open emergency child care centers? So we opened two of our centers as emergency child care centers. And then as soon as we were allowed to, we opened all of our centers to serve everyone. So we implemented a lot of the health and safety protocols, which included masks and hand washing. Parents are not allowed in the building, so we do drop off and pick up outside, and have really implemented a lot of protocols that limit the interaction of people, teachers, parents, so that there's a limit of interaction of people.
What surprised you with all of that? Were you able to maintain the quality of the services? Were they hamstringed by the protocols that were put in place? And where are you now that it seems like we're coming out of the COVID era?
What I think has surprised me is that how understanding people were, that our teachers are our people too. And so people were just very understanding that and appreciative that our teachers were, you know, putting themselves at risk to teach their children. That we were not putting nothing was different as far as the quality of care. And in fact, in many ways, the ratios in the classroom and all of that have been the same or better because the group sizes are smaller than what they might normally be.
Brenda, if somebody would like more information about Concordia Place, how can they find you?
Go to concordiaplace.org.
This is Joe Geiger in the Lincoln Radio Program. And again, my guest today is Brenda Swartz, the president and CEO of Concordia Place in Chicago, Illinois. Brenda, it sounds like you're doing great work. Thank you for what you do. Back to you, Loman.
The nation's abundant supply of affordable energy is being threatened by policy changes under consideration in both Washington, D.C. and in Harrisburg. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has details on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Energy is present in everything we do in our daily lives. Abundant, affordable, and reliable energy is the key driver of our prosperity and security. A robust and diverse supply, guided by market signals, free of handouts and contradictory rules, is essential for economic prosperity. Washington and Harrisburg pose several notable threats to this vision for energy. At the state level, Governor Tom Wolf seeks to unilaterally enter Pennsylvania into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, referred to in short as REGI. The Northeastern Interstate Compact oversees a regional cap-and-trade program limiting CO2 emissions from fossil fuel-fired power plants. REGI was a key feature of the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan regulation, and they pointed to it as a multi-state trading regime that would satisfy their standards. A September 2020 MIT analysis found that the Clean Power Plan would have cost the lowest income Americans hundreds of dollars a year on their electricity bills. Indeed, 8 of 10 REGI states have higher electricity rates than Pennsylvania. As of September 2020, these costs were 25% higher. If our electricity costs were to grow to the average of REGI states, an average PA family would pay more than $466 on electricity bills annually. REGI has also proved monumentally ineffective at its stated goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. However, it has been effective in raising billions in revenue for politically connected projects preferred by governors in participating states. The nonpartisan Congressional Research Service confirmed in 2019 that REGI's contribution to reducing greenhouse gases is arguably negligible. Here in PA, Governor Wolf has overseen PA's entry into this initiative alone, without consultation or input from the legislature. Thankfully, Representative Jim Struzzi and Senator Joe Pittman of Indiana County have reintroduced their legislation that would require legislative oversight to enter a program like REGI. Last session, House Bill 2025 was vetoed by Governor Wolf. Just several votes short of an override last session, we could absolutely realize a different result this session. So continuing to press leadership to run this session's bills is critical. On the federal front, there are numerous threats. First, the inclusion of Green New Deal-style provisions into President Biden's infrastructure proposal would mean nearly $1 trillion for clean energy projects. For example, the Clean Future Act proposes achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions by imposing on states a top-down cap-and-trade scheme that even unions acknowledge would cost millions of good-paying jobs. Biden's plan also incorporates California-style bans on gas-powered cars through massive incentives for electric vehicles, the creation of a national climate bank, and civilian climate corps. A recent analysis from MIT showed that top-down decarbonization efforts, whether through cap-and-trade, sectoral greenhouse gas regulation, or through carbon taxes, will cost the lowest-income American families hundreds of dollars per year on their electricity bills. And second, rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline and other energy infrastructure will eliminate jobs. It will disproportionately hurt low-income communities, will worsen energy poverty, and it will fail to achieve its environmental objectives. You know, federal red tape adds years of delay and millions of dollars of cost to infrastructure and energy projects. And AFP supports the removal of energy, environmental, and climate regulations and permitting hurdles that constrain choice and replace consumer preferences with politically preferred technology and fuels. Top-down regulations will hurt the very people who Washington and Harrisburg should be helping. As a grassroots organization, we rise daily with the sole intention of scaling the voice of Pennsylvanians from Pittsburgh to Philly, Scranton to Erie, and Potter to Franklin. But without your engagement, state and federal legislators receive a pass from accountability. But with your help, we can ensure they receive thanks for support of sound policy and accountability for support of harmful policy. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity. Find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
The 2021 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now just days away. After being virtual last year, an in-person conference will be held this coming Friday and Saturday, June 11 and 12, at the Radisson Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of conservative activists each year here in the Keystone State. This year's featured speakers will be Jesse Waters, host of Waters World on the Fox News Channel, Fox News contributor Jason Chaffetz, along with John Gizzi of Newsmax. Complete information and registration for the 2021 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference coming up this next weekend can be found at paleadershipconference.org. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.
Thank you.